which, you know, could take, you know, could take 10 to 20 years, depending on how that process goes.
By the way, then, do those domes get, do you take the domes down? Is everything above ground also going to be like you never even knew there was a nuclear generating system there? Does everything get to go above ground as well?
Yeah, so by 2029, the domes will be gone. We'll start working on those probably in the 2025, 2026 time frame. And the way they're going to bring those down is they weaken a section of the bottom of the domes, let's say, you know, an 8 to 10 foot section, and then the dome will sort of collapse down, and then they'll remove that material and then weaken another 8 to 10 foot section, and it'll just keep collapsing down until it's all gone. And so, yeah, by 2029, the domes will be gone. The only things that will be left will be the electrical switchyard, which, you know, if you've seen the power lines that go across I-5, so those will remain. That's a interconnect between San Diego Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison. That will remain. The spent fuel will remain. And then there's a public walkway that fronts the ocean that goes from San Onofre State Beach to the north to San Onofre State Beach to the south. That will remain, as well as the seawall and the riprap. That's okay. There.
Well, John, on that note, unfortunately, we're out of time already. It went really fast. You are welcome to come back another time. Maybe we could even further our conversation and get a little more information on there. But I did want to thank you for showing up here today and talking with us about this. If you want to mention your meeting one more time before in February, do you want to mention that real quick?
Yeah. So we've been holding quarterly community engagement panel meetings. We've had 35 of them so far. We started in 2014, I believe. And it's a great opportunity for people to find out what's been going on at Songs. And so on February 10th, the meeting's going to be at noon. We do it through Microsoft Teams because of COVID. And you can go to our website and get the information to join the meeting. And we're going to have a representative from the Department of Energy who's going to be there to talk about this new initiative that they have to kickstart the spent fuel storage program. We're going to have a representative from the Nuclear Energy Institute there who's also going to give us sort of a national perspective. And then we'll be hearing from Orange County Supervisor Lisa Bartlett and San Diego County Supervisor Jim Desmond as well on the coalition and sort of a local perspective on sort of, you know, why it's important that we undertake these actions.
Okay, so, is that songscommunity.org? Would that be the
.com?
.com. Songscommunity.com. Yeah, and you'll see
an excellent resource of information.
Thank you. Perfect.
Well, thank you all for listening for OC in Focus. I'm your host, Karen Bauer, along with co-host Mark Spinn. Thank you, John, for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you all for tuning in.
Hey, it's Mimi Chen here. If you think it's important to have a platform for music discovery, new and emerging artists, and making where we live great through access to music and culture, please let your voice be heard by donating to support this public radio station. We are asking everyone to give as generously as possible during this annual June pop-up drive, even you late-night, early-morning listeners, and especially if you've never given before. Donate online at thesocalsound.org and check out the many thank you gifts on offer right now.
Julie Slater, your midday host on Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Every weekday just after 12 noon, we do a little 88.5 album dive, digging into a brand new record, getting to know it a little better. And every Friday at 1 o'clock, Jason Friday pops in for Friday on the Friday. Get onto the bus, the Julie Slater Midday Show bus, right here on 88.5, the SoCal Sound.
Get onto the bus, that's gonna take.
We continue on KCSN with On Point, CSUN's news and public affairs show produced by CSUN journalism students.
Hello and welcome to On Point. I am Tracy Mejia. There's a word you often hear in debates about housing in LA, gentrification. The term describes the many changes that follow when higher income people move into neighborhoods that have historically been havens for lower income residents. Often, gentrification brings new resources into a community, new developments, new job opportunities, and lower crime rates. But often, gentrification also ends up forcing lower income residents out of their neighborhood, as rents or home prices rise, or as landlords and developers force their eviction. Across the U.S., the National Community Reinvestment Coalition found that gentrification displaced at least 135,000 Black and Hispanic residents from their neighborhoods. And local independent businesses often face competition from new developments and corporate chains. But LA also simply needs more housing. In 2020, the California Housing Partnership estimated that Los Angeles County would need about 500,000 affordable homes just to meet the needs of the low-income households. Can we build those units while also avoiding the worst side effects of gentrification? Will Los Angeles ever be an affordable and equitable city? Would allowing lower-income residents to have more input in the planning and approval process of new projects ensure that their concerns are being taken into account? On Point's Gitanjali Mahapatra has more.
Thank you, Tracy. And joining me today are two guests, Jackie Cornejo from the Los Angeles Housing Department, Housing Planning and Economic Analyst from the Public Policy and Research Unit, and Dr. Gustavo Leclerc, Associate Director of City Lab in UCLA's Urban Humanities Initiative Program. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
So a question for both of you, you can kind of take turns and answer, but gentrification is kind of a hot topic word that's oftentimes misused. In that spirit, can you define exactly what gentrification is?
I would just say that it's also a very complicated term. Gentrification really is private corporate actors driving economic activity in a historically underinvested community, subsequently motivating private individual market actors, typically wealthier and whiter folks, to move in and displace poor residents, and then attracting new economic activity once that said neighborhood is quote unquote transformed. The effects of gentrification typically have devastating and destabilizing effects on poor people of color. And in Los Angeles in particular, in the last decade or so, you've seen those changes in neighborhoods like Hollywood, Silver Lake, Echo Park, and now you're increasingly seeing that in South Los Angeles.
Dr. Clark, anything to add?
As Jackie say, gentrification is a complicated word and often is used as a catch-all word. And I think it's important to kind of look at how gentrification works in a specific context. And one definition that I kind of like to use is that gentrification begins when wealthy individuals, the gentrifiers move into low-income neighborhoods and begin to invest in those areas for profit. The increase value of property values result in higher prices that in return end up forcing the poorer residents out of their neighborhood. One thing that I think is gentrification of all kinds has in common is that affects housing affordability, but also the neighborhood character, the neighborhood cultural identity.
Yeah. So one real-time example of gentrification is the closing of swap meets across Southern California. Swap meets, which are similar to flea markets, are places where small business owners are able to gather, sell goods, make a living. Economic and developmental pressures have closed swap meets in Southern California, including the Union swap meet that was shut down to build apartments and a retail complex, and the San Bernardino swap meet, which was replaced with affordable student housing and a new workforce training facility. On Point's Debbie Martinez has a story of another swap meet closing for good in March in North Hollywood.
Angelica Martinez sells toys at the North Hollywood swap meet. She's one of the many business owners who received a letter from the swap meet owners in mid-February saying that the market will close. Business owners will have until the end of March to vacate their stalls. Martinez is not sure what she's going to do with all her inventory and is unsure of how she's going to get by financially, after the swap meet closes.
What are we going to do? I'd rather give everything discounted so I could at least leave with something. Like I said, this affected us so much because a one-month warning wasn't enough.
Martinez is paying $700 a month. She says a station at another swap meet can cost up to $3,000.
My location isn't that big, but what I had would help me pay for my bills.
Martinez said a petition to keep the swap meet open has been going around. She hopes public outcry can save the businesses there. In North Hollywood, I'm Debbie Martinez.
Angelica Martinez believes owners are going to build luxury apartments since other new apartments have gone up nearby. In their letter, the swap meet owners said they were unable to renew their lease with the landlord. We reached out to the owner, Fred Kim. He declined to comment. Kind of just as a reaction to that, my question is, should all new developments, like what's going to be built at the North Hollywood swap meet, be considered gentrification?
If you want to start, Gustavo, or I can take a
break. Go ahead.
I have heard of the situation in North Hollywood, and it is deeply unfortunate what is happening there. I grew up going to swap meets, because it often was the first place you could be able to buy anything if there weren't any stores in your neighborhood, and things were sold at a discounted rate. I think that unfortunately what is happening is that because land is so scarce in a city like Los Angeles, it is putting additional pressures on land that would otherwise be available for a use like a swap meet. I would say that not every single kind of development should be considered gentrification, because at the end of the day, underinvested communities still need grocery stores, parks, better schools, improved sidewalks, clean air, affordable housing, all of these other amenities that higher resource and wealthier communities need. The other challenge that we have in Los Angeles is that the vast majority of land is zoned single family, which really puts a lot of pressure on land that is not for that purpose. And so not only is that making land available scarce for a thing like a swap meet, but also for housing itself. And that's really sort of the crossroads in which the city of LA is currently at. You know, we need to be able to have those cultural and economic spaces for working class people. And we also need to create housing that is desperately needed at affordable levels for its poorest residents.
You know, Jackie, I'm really glad you actually brought up zoning, because we actually talked to Jenna Hornstock, who's the Deputy Director for Land Use for the Southern California Association of Governments, or SCAG, and she had this to say about the difficulties of housing people in Los Angeles that actually had a lot to do with zoning.
Yes, it's hard to get to affordable housing, particularly if you're a homeless person, and a lot of our homeless population has different diagnoses, although these days, unfortunately, also, well, it's unfortunate all around. These days, it's not just dual diagnosis where you might have like drug and alcohol and mental health, but there are also just families and folks that can't make it work. So it is hard to access housing, but there's like a larger stepping back issue, which is we literally just don't have enough housing. So it's a more complicated issue than that. There are a multiplicity of reasons that we don't have enough housing. Historically, we as a region, Southern California has downzoned over the last 50, 60, 70 years, meaning where, say, apartments could be built, we've made it more difficult to build them through zoning.
Going off of that, who exactly is in charge of making decisions when it comes to zoning laws, and what kind of development projects are most commonly approved by zoning administrators?
I think that's a Jackie question.
It's a number of, I would say it's a multi-pronged question or multi-pronged answer. At the end of the, you know, we have our planning department, which really helps implement land use and zoning regulations that are either at the state level or at the county and local level. We also have our housing department, which helps implement some of these local regulations, particularly around affordable housing or around our rental stock. We also have building and safety, that oversees basic building code, building and safety code, to ensure that what we are building is safe and seismically sound. And so it takes a number of different departments to be able to. We also, you know, interact with fire. So it requires a lot of different departments to really coordinate to ensure that housing and any kind of development is built in the city. At the state level, we also have a number of laws that we now have to adhere to, and increasing in the last several years to ensure that we as a city and jurisdictions across the state are really building the housing that we need, right, to accommodate all residents and to address this homelessness crisis. And in addition to that, we also have our elected officials. You know, we have our 15 city council members and our mayor who also really drive our development decisions. And then if we go into a much deeper level, we also have our neighborhood councils and our homeowners association. So land use is a really entrenched and involved process. It's not as simple as, you know, turning on a switch and saying we want this built here.
Los Angeles has been a city that historically favors development. You know, they equate development with progress. What is critical, in my view, is that communities are part of the planning process. You know, the city, the government makes little or no effort in truly engaging the people that lives in those communities, and they're gonna, you know, be directly affected and most affected by the policies and decisions of what is developed. You know, and I think that's one condition that I see is starting to change. The organizations, community, grassroots groups starting to organize, to express their concerns directly, be engaged in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, communities are such an important part of any kind of city, especially one as big as LA. So, Dr. Leclerc, I feel like you would probably have a lot of insight. What's kind of the line between gentrification versus fixing a neighborhood to make it safer for its residents? And who gets to determine that line?
Yeah, that's a great question. Gentrification is a complicated term, and it's good to look at it specifically. You know, change is inevitable, you know, but what kind of change and how that change affects different people? And one of the things that I think is important, gentrification can happen at two scales, at the scale of the individual, like person-to-person transactions, like someone wants to buy a home, someone wants to make a profit of a home, that's one way, but then at the scale of the developer. The scale of the developer historically has been unregulated or little regulation. And in most cases, the effects of those developments are really detrimental to the communities, to low-income immigrant communities.
Okay, so low-income immigrant communities, you think, should have the most say in what is considered gentrification?
Well, there are two of the communities that are most and deeper affected by mm-hmm. those changes.
So we will hear one more time from Jenna Hornstock on one way to prevent displacement in the city of LA as they continue to develop new buildings and new housing.
When you start making the neighborhood seem better or it looks better and there's new development and new activity, people who are currently living there are pushed out. And so coupling it with tenant protection laws, you know, is an important thing to do. And again, it's not easy. Those pressures are there and you have to go in intentionally. Another core thing to do is preserving existing affordable housing and what we call naturally occurring affordable housing, or NOAA. There are some apartment buildings, say there's a neighborhood that's maybe already, it's lower income, just from history or for whatever reason, meaning folks are able to live there and the rents in that neighborhood are more or less affordable, not with a capital A, there's no covenants, but you could afford to rent an apartment there or barely. It's hard in LA anywhere, right? But you're living there and then all of a sudden there starts being these gentrification pressures because things are changing. If you can buy those existing apartment buildings and covenant them, a covenant means it must be affordable and you're holding the rent slower. That's called preserving those naturally occurring affordable units. So a preservation strategy is really important to a larger anti-displacement strategy. So you're not just building new units, you're protecting the folks living in existing units, right, by covenanting those units.
So do you think covenanting units in the city of LA could not only help the housing crisis, but also the admittedly very large homeless population to get them into more housing, get their quality of lives up?
I mean, definitely. It's one of several strategies that the housing department is actively engaging in. So we have a couple of key programs in the department that are overseen by our various bureaus. One of them is what we call our managed pipeline, and that's new construction. Much of that is through Proposition HHH, which was approved by the voters in 2016, and it was, you know, a goal of 10,000 permanent supportive housing units. 10,000 is, I would say, a fraction of what we need, but it's a goal. Right. It's an important goal that our department is really pushing. Right. And we're almost there. We're just shy of 8,000 units as of February 2022. And then overall, we have about 10,000 units in that pipeline. And those are, supportive housing units that will be covenanted. And those are at 55-year, terms. Typically, that's what many of the state grant programs, really hold those terms to. In addition to that, we also have, ensuring that we hold landlords accountable to our rent stabilization ordinance or rent control. So it's just to make sure that people are not being illegally evicted, right, especially during the emergency order, which is still in place. And then also ensuring that the current units that are covenanted, and let's say their terms are about to expire, that those are then extended so that they don't then go into market rate. And those tenants are then at risk of eviction or being pushed out of their neighborhood. So there's a number of strategies that the department is currently engaging in. I would say the number one thing that we need is funding. And what we keep pushing for. Our department is very active in pushing the state for additional resources, whether it's rental assistance right now during the pandemic or funding for new construction and home ownership opportunities, which are just becoming even few and far between. But regardless, we still need it. But funding is so critical right now. We just don't have enough of it. I think right now that the state budget is currently in process is one of the many things that we've even been pushing the federal government to take a larger responsibility on is funding. We can't do it without it. There are other jurisdictions that spend far more funding than the city of Los Angeles, and we should be spending more funding and we should be getting more resources for that given our share of the population.
Dr. Kirk, do you have anything to add on that topic?
No, just that the loss of residents, of course, is a priority, but also losing the identity of a neighborhood is really, really bad. For a city, Los Angeles is rich in diverse histories, experiences. You know, we had neighborhoods that really express that in the environments and in their own places. In the area that we are studying recently, Westlake, we see that it has a very strong street life culture, particularly at night. with full street vendors, preachers, musicians, artists, you name it, and house population is rich and dynamic. It's not perfect, but, you know, how do we keep the character, the identity or neighborhood? I think it's like a two fights, parallel fights, you know. If not, our cities are going to start to look all like, you know, like the art district.
Yeah. Yeah, they all become pretty monotonous. So UCLA's City Lab is basically a think tank to kind of help, like, with housing development and kind of stuff like that. So do you think you guys have a good solution for preserving housing and culture?
I'm not a housing expert. In City Lab, we focus on different aspects. Unfortunately, Dana Kaff, which is a housing expert, couldn't be part of the panel. But they is one of the main concerns, and there's research that we've been doing, and we were really involved in developing the policies for AUDs to pass legislation. We did a research that led to legislation to allow AUDs in working class neighborhoods. So it's a big concern, and we're looking for ways to address that issue. And for us, we are a multidisciplinary tank. So we have urban planners, architects, but well, like historians, so people from cultural studies, etc.
Can you go back a bit and explain what exactly is an AUD? I feel like I've never heard that term before.
It's a practice that has been done for a long time, particularly in immigrant neighborhoods, where you build, you convert a space that is not designated for living into a living space. It could be a garage, it could be an additional room, the back of the house. It started as unregulated, but in neighborhoods, many neighborhoods were doing. Then the research that Dana Kaff and a team from City Lab did about densification and ADUs was led to legislation that was passed. So now in residential, some residential areas, is legal to build an extra unit on top of the garage or on the back of the house.
Since we're circling back to the housing topic, what exactly does the label affordable housing refer to, and who really benefits from that?
I think as Commissioner Hornstock mentioned, you know, typically, at least in our department, there's two definitions that we normally point to. There's capital A, capital H affordable housing, which is deed restricted, covenanted affordable housing that may have income restrictions to ensure that it is affordable for the household, and may also serve special needs populations that may also capture permanent supportive housing, housing for persons with disabilities, senior housing also kind of falls within that umbrella. Then there's affordable housing, sort of lowercase a, lowercase h, and that really refers to, generally speaking, housing that is affordable to that particular area or sub-market area within a community or city. You know, and what we typically hear of is, you know, housing that is, you know, is no more than, you know, a third or 30% of someone's income, right? And oftentimes you might hear of NOAA, right, or naturally occurring affordable housing, which is housing that is not quite affordable, right, in the, you know, normal definition, but is affordable for that particular community.
Do you think it's at all possible for LA to build all the housing it needs without displacing underprivileged communities?
We have a great opportunity to do that right now. We, you know, have been working on our housing element, which we're required to by state law. And our department, along with the city planning department and the broader city family, have a huge responsibility right now to make sure that we meet our regional housing needs allocation. Within the 8-year period, we have to build close to 400, we have to accommodate about 460,000 units of housing. So we have to